Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Bunker Daily. I'm Andrew Harrison. It's the beginning of another strange, unreal week, a time when every day is like Sunday, except somehow even less eventful. So why not start the week by talking about the end of the world? Apocalyptic thinking has been all around us since the end of the Second World War, and in the internet era, it seems to have intensified. Behind entirely reasonable worries about climate change, political extremism, the breakdown of democracies, resurgent nuclear threat, and the destruction of the natural world, there is, among some, a kind of relish for the end times. Why is this? Mark O'Connell is the author of Notes from an Apocalypse, A Personal Journey to the End of the World and Back, published this week by Granta Books. He won the Welcome Prize for his previous book, To Be a Machine, about transhumanism, and his new book explores the landscape of the end of the world. He visits Chernobyl and eco-retreats. He investigates billionaire bolt holes from Dakota to New Zealand to Mars. He charts the psychology of apocophilia and tries to find a little bit of hope at the end. And he's here with me today. Hello, Mark. How you doing?
Hey, Andrew. How are you?
Very well, thank you. There are two notes of hope in the title of the book. It's an apocalypse, not the apocalypse. And it's a journey to the end of the world and back. Did you feel you needed to put a bit of hope in there?
Yeah, actually, as is often the way with books, the title was my own, and the subtitle was the kind of result of an ongoing conversation with my editors. So yeah, the note of hope was seen as a kind of a necessary counterbalance to the quite stark title. So yeah. But there is some hope in the book. Yeah.
There is. I mean, it is a fascinating read, and there actually is some very very amusing bleak humor in there. But where did the impulse to write it come from? I mean, you describe yourself as loitering with intent on the fringes of the end of the world. Intent to do what?
I mean, the book, I suppose, came initially out of this sense of sort of formless anxiety about the way things were going, about climate change and about the sort of breakup of democratic global orders and all these ways in which the world seemed to be sort of sliding towards chaos and the sense that there was something very dark on the horizon. And that for me was sort of experienced in sort of stark contrast to what I was going through as a parent of a very young child, because, you know, as a parent of children, you kind of have to have some hope. You know, there's a sense that you have to instill in a child an understanding of the world as a good place, a beautiful place, and you know, the future is a realm of possibility and hope. And that was very much at odds with things that I was seeing. You know, you open the newspaper and all you get is a sense of the darkness on the horizon. And so I wanted to write about that. And I guess that sort of coincided with a preoccupation with doomsday preppers and, you know, people who were building luxury bunkers and the super rich preparing for the collapse of civilization. All those things were kind of obsessions of mine around that time. And it became clear to me at a certain point that those obsessions were a way for me to write about my kind of, you know, underlying anxiety. And the apocalypse as an idea kind of came into view then as a way that I could encapsulate all those sort of various concerns. So it is, I mean, the title is Notes from an Apocalypse, which does, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that sounds hopeful. I suppose it is. I mean, I guess the sort of one of the underlying points of the book is that, you know, it might be an apocalypse, but it's not the end of the world, you know, because it's always some form of apocalypse, you know.
Yeah.
Look through human history, there's always something.
Well, that is the key strange thing. As a species, we seem to be obsessed with it. I mean, you look back, as long as recorded history is available, people are expecting the imminent and immediate end of the world. Where does this come from? Is it something hardwired into human beings?
It seems to be, or at least it seems to be hardwired into our culture, into Western culture. I mean, there are various theories about this. A lot of them come from sort of religious scholars and so on. But it seems to me that the idea of the apocalypse allows us to put some shape on the chaos. You know, it's a kind of a, you know, it's like any mythology or story. It creates a container in which we can put all these kind of formless anxieties. And the idea of the apocalypse, apocalyptic kind of a fervor and so on, always seems to crop up during times of very rapid change, of real uncertainty, times of war and plague and famine and all these things. I mean, if you look at the Book of Revelation, it probably tells you, I mean, I'm not a religious scholar, but I think my sense is that it probably tells you more about the time in which it was written. You know, the religious persecution and the sort of rapid upheavals and so on, than it would tell you about any possible future.
There's a great line in the book where you describe today as being all horsemen all the time, which made me both laugh and be terrified. Right. You completed the book before the COVID-19 emergency, which seems to be developing as this kind of slow motion end of the world, which, you know, who knew the apocalypse would be both terrifying and boring. How do you see the corona response in the context of what you researched? You know, how are we reacting to a real kind of game over scenario?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I say interesting as though I'm a sort of a cool, rational observer of all of these things. I'm absolutely not. And it's like, you know, my main sort of response to this is it's a very strange time to be publishing a book. It's a strange time to be publishing any sort of book because, you know, bookshops are closed largely. And, it's just a lot of uncertainty. But certainly to be publishing a book about the apocalypse at a time when the apocalypse is sort of the term on everybody's lips, it's a strange experience and not one that I obviously would have foreseen. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, I write a lot in the book about people preparing for the end of the world in various ways. And, you know, the book starts out with a kind of unhealthy obsession with doomsday preppers, who are people who kind of obsessively prepare for some kind of civilizational collapse scenario. So, you know, stockpiling foods and preparing bunkers and, you know, bug out bags for sort of survival in the wilderness and so on. And these people are, I mean, it's a very interesting movement, for want of a better term, because they're very fixated on the idea of civilization as being extremely fragile. So, you know, they might predict any range of apocalyptic scenarios, including, you know, viral pandemic is a big one for them. And to be fair, a lot of these people might be feeling quite sort of smug at the moment with some justification. But for them, it's always society per se that is the threat. So the cause of the chaos might be, you know, a nuclear exchange or an attack on the grid by terrorist hackers or whatever it is. But the real danger, the real sort of apocalyptic scenario for these people is very often civil unrest. And it's all about protecting yourself and your family and your property from, you know, people outside. And there's this idea that as soon as a significantly serious crisis hits, then civilization, which is only ever very fragile and sort of delicate, will immediately sort of collapse and people will sort of revert to savagery. And so they're right to predict these kind of catastrophes happening. You know, if you stick around long enough, some kind of pandemic will probably happen or something, you know. But where they've been proven wrong, I think, is in that commitment to the idea of the fragility of civilization. Because, you know, with some exceptions, obviously we see images of people, you know, panic buying and fisticuffs over toilet roll in the supermarket or whatever. Although we're seeing that less, I think, now, certainly in the early days. But I think really what you're seeing is the strength of civilization, actually, in most cases. You know, you're seeing people clapping for emergency workers and medics and so on. You're seeing people by and large acting, or not acting as the case often is, in out of a sense of collective self-interest, a sense of a common good, which is very much at odds with the sort of doomsday prepper view of the world and of humanity is basically sort of a few catastrophes away from savagery.
Yes, what, three missed meals away from the warriors.
Right.
What one thing I thought really leapt out about the preface description is, fantastically detailed exploration of the weird, the psychology of these people. The kind of their go bags and their religious fixations, and they're all men, weirdly compliant wives, and you describe it as the overwrought performance of masculinity that utterly failed to conceal the cringing terror from which it proceeded. I mean, they are all guys. It's our old friend toxic masculinity again, and they're massively racist as well. The kind of the code of civil unrest and urban civil unrest, they're almost always talking about Black urban America, aren't they?
Yeah, certainly in the American context. I mean, I don't want to tie them all with one brush here because, I mm-hmm. do create some space in the book for acknowledging that, people who I know and people who I sort of casually meet often turn out to be preppers. But when I'm talking about the sort of the committed doomsday preppers and the sort of people who are obsessively kind of, consuming the prepper products and making YouTube videos and so on. Yeah, their anxieties are very often racially encoded and not very heavily racially encoded either. So, there's a real, they tend to set off like urban populations, which already is, you don't need to be a sociologist to sort of, against, rural populations. And the fear is large, densely populated urban areas becoming unstable and violent and civil unrest breaking out and people, coming out into the countryside. And they fear, riots and what they call, they're big on acronyms, these preppers. So the sort of preferred acronym here is WROL, which stands for Without Rule of Law. And this is the big fear, where government breaks down, police is no longer an effective force for whatever reason. And you have a sort of a Wild West scenario where you have like gangs of roaming savages and, people banding together to protect their communities from them. And, I say it's a fear, but what I try to get at in the book is the extent to which this is actually a fantasy. I say in the book, the preppers are not just preparing for their fears, they're preparing for their fantasies. And it seems to me to be very often a racist fantasy and a fantasy that harks back to the sort of mythology of the Wild West, of the kind of lawlessness of that time, every man for himself. And it is, it's a very masculinist fantasy, this idea of protecting yourself and your family and your stuff from the kind of savages on the outside of the compound or whatever.
It is kind of weird that the guys who hate government are terrified of government breaking down. I was also fascinated the degree you just mentioned they're all about the products. And you find this bizarre kind of food preparation thing called new manna, as in manna from heaven, new with an N-U, obviously. It's like kind of a Huel for neo-Nazis or something. These guys seem to want everything mil-spec. It's right. The fact that it comes in a large chunky package. I mean, I've been in certain of these supply stores and you see mil-spec lip balm, mil-spec shampoo, mil-spec toothpaste. These things don't need to be mil-spec, but of course...
right, toothpaste is fine. Any kind of toothpaste is fine, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not wartime toothpaste. Yeah. But, the idea that you're kind of buying into a complete sort of branded lifestyle message to yourself is quite fascinating psychologically.
Yeah, and it's like, it is very much a sort of a consumer subculture in a lot of ways, A lot of the videos that I got quite fascinated with were about kit, people sort of displaying their latest purchases and, this knife is very good for this, and this is a slightly better product, or, this brand of sort of reconstituted protein sludge or whatever it is will get your family through the apocalypse better than this other brand or whatever. So it's very much a kind of a consumer movement in some ways. And what you're seeing now is like sort of luxury prepper brands propping up.
Oh, really? So it's Hyatt for the better class of paranoid secessionists.
Yes. Yeah, because to some extent, prepping has gone a little bit mainstream with the viral pandemic, and so you're getting like a sort of a higher end, Instagram influencers peddling these ready made luxury bug out bags and so on. So it definitely it sort of intersects with underlying trends of consumerism and so on. And that's what's so interesting to me about it, is the way in which these sort of phenomena that can seem quite extreme and out there often reflect underlying tendencies in our culture to begin with. And, you know, I guess it was a similar kind of fascination in my first book with transhumanism, which also seemed, you know, extremely kind of out there and sort of sci-fi-ish. I was interested in it largely to the extent to which it reflected sort of the ways in which we're all a bit crazy about technology. And this is a sort of a similar thing, I think.
But the crossover there is both phenomena are essentially misanthropic. It is a dislike of other people and possibly even yourself.
I don't know that I would go so far to say that about transhumanism, although there are certainly elements of that within it, and certainly the sort of radical life extension movement within transhumanism tends to be about just, the sort of investment in the self to a very radical degree as against other people. But certainly, I mean, doomsday prepping is radically misanthropic, I think, and that's I think a pretty serious fault, because, you know, I do feel that underlying ideology of society itself being the threat has been shown up quite strongly over the last few weeks. Of course, preppers would say, well, just wait, it's early days.
You know? But that's the thing with apocalyptic cults, isn't it? It's always early days. The apocalypse is always just around the corner, and it never quite arrives.
And that's why it's, you know, that's why it's so compelling, because, you know, part of the book was I visited a sort of a luxury apocalyptic real estate salesman in South Dakota, who was, you know, this was very much part of his pitch, was that, you know, it might not be this thing, it might not be the virus, it might not be nuclear exchange with North Korea or whatever, but it could be the next thing. So, you know, and there are, you know, rationally speaking, there are any number of threats that could bring us down, that could bring down civilization or wipe out massive numbers of people. I mean, it's very hard to argue against that. So it's quite a potent sales pitch. The apocalypse as an idea is very compelling.
Well, speaking of radical life extension and bolt holes, a huge part of your journey is reporting on Peter Thiel, the big data billionaire who you describe him buying up huge chunks of New Zealand for the end of the world that he and his mates are kind of causing. Thiel is suddenly in the news for his company Palantir's involvement in tracking people around COVID for the NHS. You know, he is a fascinating and a bizarre character. He's almost like a supervillain. He's almost like something out of Marvel comics. You know, devotee of the sovereign individual, sort of anti-democracy thing, freedom and democracy are no longer compatible. What kind of world does Thiel want?
That's very much an open question. He doesn't do a lot of interviews. So, you know, I never spoke to him for To Be a Machine, and I certainly didn't speak to him for this book. He puts a lot of ideas out there. He's very much a sort of a person who thinks out loud and likes to be provocative and so on. But it seems to me, so I got very interested in his advocation of this book, The Sovereign Individual, which is co-written by two authors, James Dale Davidson and Sir William Rees-Mogg, who's, of course, Jacob Rees-Mogg's his father, former editor of the Times. And this book is like, seems to me to be very much an apocalyptic text. It predicts the sort of imminent collapse of global democracy, and it's a sort of a guide to how to thrive and survive as a sort of an investor, and how to protect your investments and sort of profit from this chaos. And Thiel is a big sort of believer in this book, and it's a radically kind of libertarian view of the future, and it predicts the rise of what they call the sovereign individual, who is this sort of very wealthy, very powerful person who is not answerable to any state or government, and just kind of creates their own personal kind of sovereign realm. And Thiel is a big sort of advocate of these kinds of ideas of, you know, democracy being a thing of the past, of the future belonging to a very small number of very powerful and influential and very clever, clued-in people. And so he's kind of advocating for this sort of post-democratic future in a way that is, I think, you know, could be seen as explicitly apocalyptic. And yeah, so I sort of got very interested in the intersection between that and his interest in New Zealand as a country, as a place where the collapse of civilization might be survived. And yeah, he bought like a huge chunk of land down in the South Island in New Zealand. So I went down there, I met up with a couple of people who had read my first book and were working on an art show based around some of the ideas that that book threw up and various other texts and ideas. They were sort of similarly preoccupied with Thiel. But you're right, he is sort of an almost like a movie villain type figure. And that's what's interesting to me about him, is that he functions for me as a kind of a symbol for the kind of sort of heartless voraciousness at the heart of capitalism. He's very much a kind of a Kurtz-like figure for me.
Mm. But one of the interesting things that leapt out from the book was, whether you're Peter Thiel or you're a prepper eating ready meals in a basement, it is fundamentally narcissistic. It's all about you. You are at the center of the story. And there's something kind of almost adolescent about it, in that, you know, the basement prepper is fulfilling the stuff that he's absorbed from pop culture. And he's kind of, you know, we've all read those memes about these sad guys who saying, you know, while you were out dating, I was practicing hand-to-hand combat. While you were going to rock gigs, it's I was exactly learning that. How to gut a deer with my teeth.
Right.
Although it's a teenage boy's vision of the world.
It is. And it's deeply misanthropic, and it's deeply kind of, it's also quite wrong, you know? And I think like one of the sort of underlying sort of threads of the book, you know, it's not a polemical book by any means, and I'm not sort of retailing any kind of argument. I'm not looking to convince people of anything so much as just explore things. But I think if there is an underlying idea in the book, it's that it's not the building of bunkers or the building of walls that's going to protect us in times of crisis and catastrophe. It's very clearly to me community, you know. Mm-hmm. And interesting, like there's been some ironies around this, of course, for me. Like when this started to happen, the virus, you know, I went through a few days a week of sort of, you know, I guess panic. And, you know, I bought a lot of prepper books for research when I was writing Notes from an Apocalypse. And I found myself sort of taking them down off the shelf and flicking through the indexes with, I would say, like something other than the sort of ironic scholarly interest that I was reading these books with, you know, in the first place. And there was, you know, there was a period when my wife and I sort of discussed, like, well, should we get it? You know, we live in Dublin in the city center, and we were sort of saying, you know, should we maybe try and rent somewhere in the country or get out of town and be somewhere like, you know, out in the open where we might be safer? And we kind of talked about this for a little bit, and then we just sort of realized, you know what, we have a community around us here. We're we're in a city. We have, like, it's a vibrant community. People sort of look out for each other. People know each other. There's, you know, businesses that people support and so on. And this is all really important. And it's proved to be a kind of a, I don't want to say a lifeline, because we're basically, you know, we're fine. But it's you know, psychologically, it's proved very comforting to just have your neighbors and sort of friends and, you know, just fellow sort of dwellers, you know, around you. So I think that's something that, you know, the sort of prepper worldview, whether it's, you know, guys, you know, putting together bug out bags or Peter Thiel hiring a private jet to go to New Zealand or whatever. That's an aspect of all of this that does not take into account.
Mm. Are you a recreational reader of apocalyptic fiction at all? Because the book reminded me quite a lot of, there's a couple of key William Gibson ideas that popped up that, you know, what the book reminded me of. One from his recent books about the jackpot, this concept that like, it's not like a super volcano or an asteroid that's going to end things. It's just a lot of little things all joining hands. It's like an economic crash in this part of the world and an ecological crash in another part of the world. And, you know, it all adds up. And another one was a line from Count Zero where he writes that the exceedingly rich are no longer even remotely human. I mean, when I said William Gibson, then you went, are you a reader of this stuff?
You know, obviously I'm sort of, you know, you can't avoid Gibson. He's sort of a huge aspect of all of this sort of discourse and a big sort of part of the culture. I was never a big reader of him. I read Neuromancer actually for the first time when I was writing To Be a Machine, because I was never a big sci-fi reader, actually, ironically enough. And I kind of went on a bit of a crash course when I was writing To Be a Machine. You know, I've always enjoyed apocalyptic narratives to some degree. For me, I guess the big person for me in terms of like fiction writers and the apocalypse would say be Don DeLillo, actually. Someone who's, I mean, I think of his, I guess it's his most recent novel, Zero K, and the first line of that book is, everyone wants to own the end of the world. I think that's the first line. And it's very much about, you know, capitalizing on apocalyptic chaos. And yeah, DeLillo is someone who I keep going back to for sort of insight into these quite apocalyptic times and how our sort of personal fear of death intersects with these grand apocalyptic sort of imageries that we get from the culture. So I haven't read a lot of Gibson. I've read Pattern Recognition years and years ago, and Neuromancer, as I said, quite recently.
Just in closing then, I mean, you're very clear from the very beginning of the book that the end of the world is your fault. You know, it's our fault. It's, you know, air travel, consumption, just doing nothing about the things that are around us. I think what the line there is, I am the apocalypse I prophesy. Mm. It's kind of our doing by neglect as much as commission. But you do end on a kind of a note of hope. How did you get to that note of hope that perhaps, you know, it's not, it may be an apocalypse, but it's not the apocalypse?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of central question of the book. And it's also like the hardest one to answer for me, because it was no one thing. I mean, you know, I could sort of shape the narrative into a fairly straightforward trajectory from, you know, the beginning of the book, in which I'm writing about a time where I was sort of maximally anxious about everything and just couldn't see a way in which it was possible to live with a sense of meaning and purpose and raise children in a world that seemed to be on a collision course with catastrophe and just extreme darkness, to a point that I write about towards the end of the book where I've reached a kind of, it's hopeful, but it's quite tentatively hopeful. There's a kind of a stoic acceptance in the mood at the end of the book that, you know, I deliberately ended the book in a way that mirrored the beginning. So the beginning of the book is a scene in which I'm watching images of a starving polar bear sort of trying to feed himself out of a trash can somewhere in the northern Arctic tundra, while my son is watching a cartoon about a cartoon bear and his sort of girl companion, and trying to square those two things and this real anxiety that arises out of that. And the end of the book is, you know, things are no different in the outside world. You know, it's just as dark, but it ends with a moment of just my daughter blowing a raspberry at me as I'm reading an article from The Guardian to my wife up from my phone about the collapse of insect populations and how that's, you know, ushering in possibly the collapse of the entire ecosystem. So it's still dark, but also there's a note of like, actually, I'm here with my family. I'm here with my daughter. I can't give in to despair. And I think where I got to was an ability to recognize the darkness on the horizon and not ignore it, but also not have that completely overshadow life in the present and life with my family. Because, you know, I think where I land with the book is that we just don't know what the future brings. Often that's a really scary thing. And, you know, the last few weeks have shown that we just don't know what's around the next corner. And, you know, I certainly couldn't have predicted this. Maybe a lot of epidemiologists could have predicted this, but I certainly didn't see this coming, and most people didn't. And so that can be dark and scary. But also there's a sense of like possibility. We don't know where the solutions are going to come from. We don't know what good things might be in the pipeline. And I think you have to have a sense of that as a parent. You have to keep in mind the sense of like the future being open-ended. And I think that's part of why we have children, is to keep the future open, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a very tentative hope, but there is some hope.
It's a tentative hope, but it is some hope. Mark, thanks for getting up so early on what is still technically a bank holiday, although how can we tell anymore, to talk to us. Weirdly, it has been a pleasure talking about the end of the world.
Same. Thank you, Andrew.
Notes from an Apocalypse is out this week, and bookshops are still delivering, I believe. Everybody out there, thanks for listening. Please do follow us on Twitter at @bonker_pod to find out what else is going on with the podcast and to let us know what you think of it. We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily. In the wise words of Idris Elba in Pacific Rim, we are cancelling the apocalypse. See you tomorrow.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.